Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
What are you doing?
Whoa, Red Bull.
What are you doing?
I'm getting a Red Bull.
Why? It's late at night. I don't know if that's true.
It's time to get high on Red Bull and play some Bioshock.
All right, it's 9:15 at night.
Jackass.
And Skynard has just very confidently cracked open a Red Bull so that she can try to finish Bioshock Infinite
tonight.
I feel like
I probably get way better at video games when I'm drinking Red Bull.
She's mad because I am ahead of her in the game.
Which is bullshit.
And that does not stand.
No, it absolutely does not stand.
Come see me in Denver, May 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. And then I'll be at Comedy Works in Denver. And then a week after that, at Helium in Portland. And then in London on the 15th, I think, and the 16th at the Leicester Square Theater. And then I announced some dates in the fall at the Wilbur Theater in Boston. And then in at the Carolina Theater in North Carolina. So go to Nerdist.com/calendar for that business. I'd like to thank Stamps.com for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Official U.S. postage is at your fingertips. It's like you're a weird postage wizard, and you can cast a mail spell and then just print it. Don't say anything. And just print it. Just go with it. So be the mail wizard. He's a mail wizard.
You just print them?
You print them out, yeah.
I don't know what happens.
Well, your printer is like a wand.
Yeah.
And it prints them out.
Do you have to lick them?
No, they're sticky.
Because I heard a rumor that, like, stamps, if you lick them, sometimes they have bug eggs on them. So, pointstamps.com.
Yeah, so
stamps.com, bug-free stamps.
Well, how come that's not their slogan?
The Red Bull is kicking in already.
Stamps.com is a special offer for Nerds Podcast listeners, which is $110 no-risk trial, including a digital scale and up to $55 of free postage using the promo code Nerdist. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click the microphone at the top of the homepage. Type in Nerdist. That's Stamps.com. And enter the promo code Nerdist. Hey, this podcast is a three-peat. It's Mark Maron. You've heard of him. Maron has his IFC show, which is premiering May 3rd, which is a fantastic win for all podcasters because he has ported the podcast to a television show, and I actually have seen the first three episodes, and the show's good. So it's Friday, May 3rd on IFC at 10, 9 Central, and Mark's a lot nicer to me these days, although I really feel like, he tolerates me. I don't know if he really likes me or is a fan of my work, but at least he's pleasant. So that is a dramatic improvement over what our relationship used to be, which is me just saying, hey, how's it going, and then being insulted. So
here's the guy that might hate me.
He might, I don't know, but he's nice to me now. He's very nice to you.
He's pretty nice.
He's really nice to you.
I like Mark.
But I gotta say, I think this was the best conversation we've ever had. Here's the Nerdist Podcast number 349. Yeah, 349.
Just go with it.
I'm going with it.
Yep.
Mark Maron.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
I don't know if we're going to be in the studio much longer.
Yeah?
Where are we going to go?
Meltdown.
Meltdown?
Taking really? Over the annex.
That's right. I heard about that. That's great. I'm bummed that it's going to stick around because it's a cool spot. And he's put a lot of money into it.
Yeah. He was going to give it up, and I was like, "We'll take it."
What's that?
That's the little used to be a Russian store right next to Meltdown.
Yeah. No. It's between that and the Russian store.
Oh,
yeah. It was a salon or store space
that he had.
And Gaston took it over, and they were doing pop up shops there and stuff. And then,
yeah.
But I think
Kevin Eastman, who did
Ninja Turtles, and then. And so I just found out he was going to give the space up, and so we just, I think
What's
we're going to take it over.
What's a pop-up shop?
It's like a temporary store. Yeah. Like, say it's like an online store that wants to actually have a physical store for a moment.
Right.
Yeah. So and then the RZA took over.
It's like half art exhibit, half store.
Right. But then upstairs, there's like a lounge with like a DJ setup where the RZA was like streaming live DJ sets like every day for a month.
What a fun space.
Yeah.
But we're not here to talk about Meltdown. Mark Maron's back on the pod. This is your third appearance on the podcast.
Is it the third?
Repeat.
Really?
How many people have done that?
Not you. Like,
and Carolla.
And maybe Adam Savage. There's only Tom Lennon. And Tom Lennon. Yeah,
are we on?
Yeah.
This is happening?
We're always on. That's what people don't like about us.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I understand that tactic. We've discussed this.
Yeah.
You just sort of ease into it. There's no preparation.
No preparation.
Because this episode of Nerds is brought to you by stamps.com/WTF. Yeah.
Is it really?
Yeah, sure. Matt says that all the time.
Use my promotion code, WTF, stamps.com.
Yeah, Matt does that all the time.
Yeah, why not? Send him my way.
He's been fucking waiting.
Do you guys do stamps or you don't?
Yeah, we do stamps. We have a long-running thing with stamps.
Yeah, but I
all right.
Say,
well, is
I
it a competition now? My stamps running thing is longer than yours.
You can have
a longer running thing.
Nice.
I am fine for you.
I'm exhausted and vulnerable, Chris. I don't have no energy.
I am fine
to play
for
this
you to
game
have the stamp stuff
with you. Not today. I'm not going to sit here and get defensive and take shots at you so you can deflect them with your nerd jujitsu and act like everything I say is just sort of like, well, Mark's got a problem. I'm not going to do that today.
Today is not going to happen.
I have a lot on my mind. I'm tired.
Yep.
And I'm here for you today.
You're exhausted by your own success right now, though, because
That's one way to put it. I maybe I should frame it like that. Would you frame it like that? I want give me some Chris Hardwick advice.
Yep.
On how to deal with things going well.
you just toss him your book. Here you go, asshole.
I'll tell you, it's a very serious question to answer because you get into a comfort zone. Where you feel like your brain, for whatever reasons, however you're formed, whatever influences you had when you were growing up, basically tells you this is a bubble that you should live in that you deserve. And if you fall too short of that, you get uncomfortable. And if you fall too ahead of that, you get uncomfortable. So it's fucking really weird to be successful and then not subconsciously go, well, I have to dismantle that so I can get back to this place, this weird bubble of misery that I feel like I deserve.
Right, or the weirder thing is really when a lot of things are going on, everything seems to be lining up, there's that moment where, like, everything's going well for you. Like, yeah, right now.
Yeah, exactly.
You're, like, you're already like, yeah, wait till the wave crashes.
wait till the shoe drops.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't know. I don't feel like I'm so overwhelmed and so busy that I'm really... I don't have much room for dread, which is a new thing for me.
That's a good place to be.
People are like, you seem good. I'm like, got no time to panic.
But I will tell you that what will happen is you get into this, and you may already be experiencing this, but you get into this place of momentum and you're going, and you're like, hey, I'm kind of juggling all this stuff it's kind of working out.
Right.
And then you'll get like, somehow you'll get like 3 or 4 days off. And then the momentum, it's sort of like being in a vehicle and then it slams on the brakes and then you're just like, fuck, you know, you start to feel sick. You start, like, all the anxiety catches up to you. And so you just got to be careful in those moments to be aware and go, yeah, this is my brain trying to catch up on all the misery that I was putting up.
Right.
For so
yeah,
long.
I don't feel miserable. And I'm glad you said slamming on the brakes as opposed to slamming into a wall, because I can do that.
Yes.
Like, you know, in your metaphor or your analogy, there was brakes being used.
There was.
You know, in my experience, experience is like the car just stopped and I'm bleeding. Oh, it's totaled.
See,
what
you,
did I do?
You have the power in this case as opposed to something stopping you.
Yeah. Well, I also have the power to slam a car into a wall as well.
Sure. Full speed.
No. But no, things are okay, and I'm excited, but you know, when you have a lot of stuff out in the world and when things are about to enter the ecosystem of entertainment,
yeah,
there's that moment like, I, you know, look, the book's done, the show is done, but it's not out there yet. Right. So then you're just sort of like, oh, God.
You're sitting on it.
What's going to, how's this going to come at me? You know, like, it's horrible that, you have these things go out into the world and that you should be excited about it. Like, I'm going to share this with the world, but me, I'm like, I better gird her up for whatever's going to come at me.
Yeah, well, because you know, for so many years, you've sort of built up this armor expecting life is going to come at you at a certain
way. What are you talking about, Chris?
See? It wasn't an attack, Mark.
What does that mean? Why is he taking shots at me?
As he reaches for his
Mark.
I'm sorry.
I misunderstood the tone. You're actually being helpful and sensitive. And
how are you
just,
doing today? How am I supposed to be doing?
Yeah, I took that as a rock being thrown in my head.
It's really important, I think, even if you just take 2 minutes a day to start conditioning yourself to be comfortable with where you are.
Does that involve like running?
No, you don't have to. No.
running for 2 minutes, Mark.
Even if you just...
I got a kettlebell. That's nice. Supposed to only...
Tim Ferriss.
Yeah, but the problem with the kettlebell is just sitting there and I'm just wondering how I'm going to hurt myself with
that's
it.
The thing. The kettlebell...
It's fucking easy to do
that. The kettlebell is one of those things that that got trendy and it's the idea of it's really cool, but if you don't do it exactly the right way, you'll fucking ruin your back.
Yeah, I can feel that. I can see that.
Like when you see like people, I see people at the gym and they go all the way down and swing their back. I'm like, you're fucking
going
to
squat,
ruin,
right?
You got to use your pelvis.
I got a half hour kettlebell DVD along with my kettlebell, and I did it and couldn't really move for about a week.
Yeah, well, that might be you did it wrong. So let's get back 2 minutes. What do I do for 2 minutes?
So this is a thing, and I'm not saying I'm not saying I'm amazing at it. I still get overwhelmed a lot.
With the kettlebell?
Not with the kettlebell. I still get overwhelmed a lot, and I still feel like, oh, I don't want to ruin everything, and I get protective. But if you can stop and say, like, I'm going to release everything but just gratitude for this moment. Like, everything in this moment is okay.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to feel that for a second.
Yeah.
If you can kind of get into the habit of doing that, the theory that I have is that over time you'll start to get more comfortable in that space. That it's not going to – you're not, going to wake up a morning and be like, hey, I'm just grateful all the time for everything, even though you probably should be. You still – it's hard because you have to recondition. It's like – it's like trying to make a U-turn in a battleship. Like, the boat's not going to just flip around. It
right.
just takes
well,
a little bit of time.
There's a lot going on. It's sort of like the guy on the couch analogy, which I share a lot.
Yeah.
It's a recovery analogy, kind of. But the story goes that, you know, some guy, newly sober dude, calls his sponsor up, right? And he says, I'm fucked, man. Everything's fucked. Everything's like out of control. You know, that my life is shit. I don't know what the fuck I'm going to do. It's just like, it's everything is fucked. And the sponsor goes, where are you right now? And the guy says, I'm sitting on my couch. and then his sponsor goes, so you're a guy on a couch. That's all that's happening right now. And then the lesson for me there is what kind of like what you're saying is that 99% of what we're reacting to is being made up by our brain.
Yeah.
It's not a real thing.
No.
Like right now, like this is happening, but that's all that's happening.
Well, yeah, because you could put another guy on a couch who didn't have those issues and it'd be like, hey, we're on a couch. Like, yeah, there's
no, you're on a couch. I'm in trouble. Yeah. I'm drowning on this couch.
This is a trouble couch.
Yeah. You're on the trouble seat. No, but things are all right, man. I'm okay.
Well, I think, it's just that you get into these sort of mental cul-de-sacs where you know so much of your life you're fighting and it's like, especially for career, and it's like, I'm the underdog and I gotta fight, and every day I'm gonna go out and punch this tree and sooner or later it's gonna fucking fall over, and then one day the tree falls over but you're still a fighter, and so you're still like, ah, I just gotta keep, and so you kind of it's sort of weird to go from, you know, like underdog punk rock to like, okay, maybe I don't have to fight all the time.
Yeah, I wish I could characterize myself as any of those things, underdog punk rock or a fighter. But I think that I'm driven by a certain amount of panic, and I've accepted the underdog moniker because I feel like that sort of is my story at this juncture in my life. But I'm not like, my ambition is completely driven by sort of like, oh, we gotta do the thing. You know, it's not. You know, it's never sort of like, I got a strategy, I'm going to punch this out. It's like, what if I don't? How come? God damn it. Yeah, that's more my disposition.
Yeah.
And that's my creativity. I don't know if the panic goes away, I don't know what's going to be there.
Mark goes away.
Oh, no.
No, Mark just changes into something else.
Changes into a guy that sits down. He takes it easy.
Yeah. Looks at things.
Well, I mean, you know, listen, if anyone deserves the success that you, I mean, it's, you worked a really long time, and you know,
yeah,
you did,
really
you
long
did
time.
Far, you did fight for it.
We didn't think it was going to happen.
It's
did
a really
we?
Long
None
time.
Of us, yeah, you're right. You're right.
None of us.
When the shit hit the fan, I had no plan B. There was no other option. That horrible moment, I've talked about it before, where you're like, where you don't have any more plan Bs, where you hit the wall and you're like, fuck this. I could always, wow. There used to be stuff in that folder.
There was the three of us were at a show. Why
graduate school used to be in there, I think.
Why is my hope chest empty?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, can you be in your 40s and start a coffee shop? How does that work?
I think you have to be in your 40s to start a coffee shop, actually.
What did you say about the House of Blues?
Oh, yeah. Well, I remember the three of us were on a show at the House of Blues Foundation Room.
Yeah,
I remember
that.
It was the day that George Carlin died.
Was I mean to you that day?
Probably.
All right. Yeah.
No, you were to me, like, Chris was on stage, and that was, I think, around the time you really started pushing a lot, like, more of, like, talking about stuff you liked on stage.
Well, that was when I first started feeling comfortable on stage.
Yeah.
Wasn't that your show?
No, it wasn't my show. I can't remember the guy,
but it was a fun
It was a
room.
Fun show. It was a cool show. But I remember that was also the day Carlin died, and so everyone was kind of, like, making references to it on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, Chris was, like, I forget what you were talking about. But you were like pacing in the back. You're like, nerd stuff, huh? and then we were like in the back area of the bar, like waiting to go on. And like, and that's when you're like, I'm like, hey, how's it going, Mark? And you're like, fucking wife is gone. I don't know what I'm going to do. A fucking radio show is not around. Like, you just were fucking.
That must have been right before the podcast.
It was before the podcast. Yeah. And like, it was one of those things where it's like, you know, when you can't help but feel. Where it's like, say you're like really heartbroken, someone goes, how you doing? You're like,
what do you want?
Yeah.
Which story?
Yeah.
I'm
yeah,
okay.
But not everyone, I mean, it's, you know, we're very fortunate because of what we do that we have this therapeutic outlet that ultimately can actually become a career. Like most other people don't. If you work at a bank and you have those feelings, you may not necessarily have the tools to have that as a creative outlet. But to sort of take all that stuff and focus it into your work is a pretty amazing thing to be able to do.
Yeah, and then after you've been doing it long enough, you're like, this is all I do. It was odd because I've been touring and I've been doing a lot of stuff, you know, promoting the book and trying to, you know, promote the TV show and like, you know, getting ready for all that stuff. But I'm shooting a special in New York in 2 weeks. And I was touring a lot, doing hours, hour and a half shows and like feeling like you're in that groove. And then like literally I had like 3 weeks off. And from not doing stand-up, like, you know, maybe a couple of short sets, but it was amazing with all the stress that I'm sort of in, how quickly that became the only defining thing in my life. Like, within 2 weeks, I was sort of like, I'm not even funny anymore. Jeez. I can't, like, I'm not a fucking stand-up. What am I? I'm lying to my, like, by the third week, by the time I went to Boston to do these shows, I'm like, I have no idea whether or not I can even be on stage anymore.
That's important for young comics to hear you say that because it, you know, just to hear that someone who's been doing comedy and who in their minds has figured it out, to hear like you still, I mean, it's either comforting or it's horrifying at the same time to be doing comedy for a long time.
So go,
what the fuck am I doing?
Well, what it says to me is that is really that is how I define myself, that no matter what else I'm doing, that in my mind, I always have stand-up. Stand-up is what I set out to do. I've always been a stand-up comic. So when everything starts to feel like it's not so much that I'm insecure, but when you're anticipating things and things are about to happen in your life or life gets a little chaotic or things are a little overwhelming, like everything is about the stand-up. Like I know that no matter what is going on, I can get on stage and perform. But when you start not doing that for a couple weeks because you're too busy or whatever, and you start to doubt that, you literally, or I'm speaking about myself, I'm like, well, who am I? What do I even do? Yeah. And then I seem to need to put myself into that panic because the shows that I did do were amazing. And I had to deal with the feelings I was having right at that moment publicly and kind of address them and bring that juice to it. It's not a great system. I think it's probably better just to have an act and be okay with the stuff that you've created to share with people as opposed to go up there like, you know, and have your opening line, you know, be like, you know, I don't know if you guys know what's hinging on this set, but I'm in trouble. You know, it's not a great place to put an audience. And I don't know that I necessarily said that, but there's definitely that feeling for me. But after I did the three shows, Like, I was like, all right, I'm back. I'm good. I know who I am.
That's what people want to see, though, because they have an intimate relationship with you because of the podcast.
Right.
So they want to feel like when they see you on stage, I don't think they want to feel like, well, these are the prefab jokes that he's set up. Like, they want to experience you as a personality as well as a comedian. So I think
that's fine.
That.
But I'm just saying, personally, after I did the shows, I felt like everything was okay. Like, because I didn't do stand-up, for 2.5-3 weeks, like long sets, I didn't know that everything was okay.
Yeah.
But by the time I did the sets, I was like, all right, I know who I am again. I know where I fit in the world. I can be all right.
I could not agree more, because I haven't been able to go on the road because I've been working on the weekends for the past 2 months. And then immediately someone said, you're not taking a break? And I go, no, I'm immediately going on the road because I don't feel right if I'm not
doing the stand-up.
I'm just mad at myself that I toyed with stand-up in college, but I didn't start really until I was 27.
I remember.
And if I hadn't gotten lucky and worked for MTV, I would have started sooner, but I just got lazy because I'm like, well, I have a job now.
I remember when you showed up at Luna, and I think I was very encouraging. I said, what's he doing here?
Yeah, to my face.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's he doing here? By he, do you mean me? Yes, he.
I mean,
do you feel that, like, do you feel that you're always trying to make up for that lost time? Because I feel like I didn't start doing comedy. Like, I wanted to do comedy out of high school, but I waited a year before I moved away from Hawaii. And then I moved out here, and then I waited another year before starting to go to open mics. And, like, I still, all the time in my head, I'm like, I should be 2 years ahead of where I'm at now.
No, I think I wouldn't have. I think I don't know if I'm happy with where I'm at now, and I don't know if I would have followed the path. Like, if I had started comedy when I was really young, I could have fallen into a totally different scene, been a totally different kind of comic, had a totally different experience, and never quit drinking. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what would have happened. And so
that's an interesting alternate reality, Chris. The guy who's still drunk and miserable and not self-actualized.
But killing in comedy and sandwiches.
Let's not push it. Let's not go crazy. We don't need to assume that part. I like the sadder.
Chris, do you think you would have died if you didn't stop drinking?
I don't think I would have died. I think who knows?
Oh, but you would have gotten in a car and driven off somewhere.
No, I never drove.
You never drove drunk.
I think what would have happened to Chris would have been, he would have been so sad that, you know, people would be like, you want to talk to him? I think that's what would have happened.
Yeah, or I would have been hanging out and kind of doing comedy, but not really. And then like, hey, guys. I mean, I was already getting that kind of near the end from people.
Yeah, you just got a little despondent is what I remember. Just sort of like you were kind of lost.
I was. I didn't.
You weren't writing much either.
No, because I couldn't. I would go on stage and my mind would be blank. Like, I did not, that romantic idea of like, you got to be fucked up to go on stage. It is not a good long-term plan.
I don't know how many people really do that anymore. I mean, there was a time where what's happening in the world today, he said, hoping that he had a point, is there's not a lot of room for that. Because, you know, we live I think the culture is driven by trolls. And I mean this in the sense that you're being eyeballed all the time, no matter what you're doing or where you are. Like back in the day, if you got fucked up and you went on stage and something fucked up happened, the only people who saw it were the people in that room, and other comics are like,
and
wow, that was a bad
night. They didn't bother to call all of their friends
or
and
tweet
tell
it
them.
Or take a picture of it or shoot it on tape. Or you have 50 people in the audience going, well, that wasn't his night. You know, so there's this weird pressure because of technology that we live in now where you're visible all the time to everybody. Yeah. On some level. And I think that's really kind of tweaked with people. I don't think that unless your thing is being fucked up, that you're going to be doing that.
It's also very antithetical to how comedy should work. Comedy, I think, is a very intimate experience. And so social media makes a comedy show all of a sudden a global experience. And then everyone who wasn't even there can weigh in. And it's like, yeah, it wasn't for all of you people. It was for this particular group of people in this experience. Of course you're probably not going to like that joke. You weren't there. That's not how comedy is supposed to work.
Well, I fortunately have cultivated an audience of fairly grown-up people and, you know, fairly respectful people. Like, it's very unique that when I do shows, the club owners or the theater owners are always like, your crowd is so nice, and they tip well, and they seem like grown-ups. I'm like, what are the odds of that? Cultivating a grown-up audience that is like respectful, and I couldn't be more grateful about that.
They don't mind sitting together because they only bought one ticket.
Yeah, there's a bit of that.
Is a little less of that lately.
Like well, that happened where the guy comes up to me. He's like, we sold a lot of tickets, but I've never sold more single tickets. But usually what that is like, I know, like, a lot of people can't explain me to, like, I know what happens. There's a guy's like excited to see me because he listens to my show or he knows my shit. And he's like, how am I going to explain Marin to my friends? Yeah. And fuck it, I'm just going to go myself. And you know, why drag somebody into it that might not get it? I don't mind being that guy. Yeah. That's okay.
Can you come with me to my crazy friend's house? Exactly. I just don't want to go by myself. Just go by himself.
But we got to see three episodes of the show. IFC sent us three episodes of the show, and it's great.
Thank you.
It's really great. And it really, like, you know, especially in the third episode, those the scenes with you and Judd Hirsch, who plays your dad, they're so well done, but it's definitely got the sense of like, oh, I think he's getting some of this shit out. Like, Judd Hirsch was basically, if you're in therapy and they're like, yell at this pillow, like, Judd Hirsch was your pillow.
Well, I'm glad you saw that, because that initially made me uncomfortable, because the things that I'm arguing with him about are all real. And they happened. Like, that stuff is taken directly from my life. And when I watch it, the interesting thing about watching it, and I don't have that relationship with my dad anymore, not verbally, but when I watched it, it was a little too raw for me in the way where I'm like, oh my God, that he's a child.
Right.
Look at him acting like, you know, this is a 49-year-old man, you know, demanding his father, you know, make up for something that happened when he was 12. And when I was watching it, I'm like, this is a little awkward.
That's not crazy, though. My dad, who had a horrible relationship with his father, my grandfather always had a way of, like, sneaking something in that would just catch my dad off guard. And he'd be like, God damn it, you got me again.
Right.
And so, you know, my dad would say, like, oh, I'm gonna do this thing at the bowling center. And my grandfather would go, ah, you're too fucking stupid to run a business. And my dad would be like, why would – ah, fuck you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my dad –
one of those little asides.
Yeah. So my dad would open up and say, listen – and this was when my dad was, like, 60, 64, and my grandfather was 79 or 80. And he'd say, you know, when I was a kid, I had this dog and you gave it away and it broke my heart. And my grandfather was like, you pussy, why didn't you get over that? And like, still, Jesus. At that age, my dad was still trying to cover those holes.
I just saw my father a week and a half ago. And I went out to dinner with him. Jessica and I went out to dinner with him and his wife. And he's still, like, he hasn't listened to a podcast. He is not. I showed him how you can go to the site. Ugh. You can push play, and he hasn't done it like that.
But can I get to there from my internet?
Right, exactly. But he's not that stupid. He's on the internet researching vitamins and, you know, whack job solutions to his depression every day. He knows how to, to deal with the internet. But he still, there's that block, and you, after a certain point, you're like, you're just not doing this. There's something wrong with this. But I'm not going to yell at him about it anymore. It's like that scene in the show where he's like, what's a podcast?
Yeah.
And I say, well, it's like a radio show on the internet. He's like, who's going to listen to that?
Well, but I love the sort of parallel of, like, you yelling at your agent, who is Brian Palermo, who's a fucking amazing improviser, by the way.
Yeah.
And you're yelling at him. You're like, I'm doing this on my own. I'm doing a podcast. And he's like, that's dumb. And then you're standing on your front lawn. Your dad's like, I'm doing my own business. Yeah, yeah, and you're like, that's dumb.
Yeah.
And then you kind of have that moment at the end where you're like, fuck.
Yeah.
I'm saying all the same shit.
Oh, I'm glad that red.
Yeah, totally red.
That's good. That's good.
Totally red.
It's a very nervous energy I have around, like, I'm very proud of the show. I think we did an amazing thing. It doesn't look like another show. It definitely honors what I do. But it, not unlike my podcast, because of how I do things, I put a lot of myself out there in a very genuine way. And once it gets bigger, you know, you can feel your heart in it. And people, I don't know if they exactly realize it, because I don't know how much they come in contact with it in this sort of, you know, ironic and snarky world we live in. But there's a lot of me in that thing that is now going to be out. Like, the podcast is one thing. You know, I can talk, and once I put it in the can, you know, it goes away, and people have their reaction to it and their relationship with me. But this is on television. There's a lot of other people involved. It's a scripted thing, but there's a lot of me in that, and it's sort of like, it's a very vulnerable place to be somehow.
Does it feel more personal for you having the television show out there?
Well, no, because it's an interesting thing that where I'm taking stories from my life and I'm sort of tweaking them a bit, because the weird thing about having a bunch of stories, especially when you're sitting with writers and you go in and, like, here are the episodes, and, like, okay, I got a story for one episode. You know, I date this dominatrix and that's all I got. So, you know, because life doesn't happen. Life doesn't have the closure that stories should have. You've got to sort of bring other things together to sort of build those things out into a story that can, you know, can run. And a lot of that, I wouldn't say it's fictionalized because the emotions are there, but you have to do a little something to it because it's a different medium and you are dealing with a scripted thing. So it's not like me just talking about my feelings on the podcast. So there's a lot of other elements. There's direction, there's the writing, there's my ability to act and be funny. There's a whole nother world that I've never done any of that stuff with any consistency. I've had a couple of acting roles, but it was a big deal.
Did you ever have the impulse when writing the stories that you would just be like, no, that wouldn't happen in my life. Let's not do that because that wouldn't happen.
It was a very small staff. It was me, Duncan Birmingham, and Sievert Glarum and Michael Jammin that were the showrunners. So there's just four of us.
Great names.
To do 10 episodes. And you know how, I don't know if people know how this works. You know, you break stories. I came in with about 9 out of the 10 stories. And you flesh them out together and then you outline them and then you assign people to go write them. You know, I wrote 2 and they wrote 2, and then you bring them back and everybody goes back into them. So it's really a group effort. So when these guys would come up with certain jokes and I'd just be like, there's no way that can come out of my mouth. I'm not going to be able to say it or it's not right for the character. So yeah, there was definitely those conversations around that type of stuff, but I have to be careful because the weird thing about talking about yourself or writing stories about yourself is that you realize how small your life is. Like, not everybody's life is huge. And when you really think about your life, especially when you're busy, you're sort of like, well, I get up, I go to the garage, I go get something to eat, and then I come back here, and I tweet for 2 hours. And then, you know, and so then, right, so then all of a sudden you're like, well, that doesn't sound like a great episode, really. Yeah. All right, well, what if I get a friend, Andy Kinler, and we go together to do the thing, and then I go talk to that girl then all of a sudden you're building out this story, because it's amazing that when you're being creative or when you're just talking, you know, your life can be sort of sedentary. But when you have to make a TV show, you're like, we've got to get this guy out in the world a little bit. You know, he's got to do some things. You know, a lot of the stories took place a couple years ago when I had more time. And that's a concern with the podcast, too, is that I better start doing things. You know, I should go to a concert or something to, you know what I mean?
Because you ran out of stuff to say.
We were just talking about the three of us with, like, you know, we got to stack up some episodes where it's just the three of us. And, like the three of us haven't hung out, like, as friends in a very long time. And that kind of, like, drops off. Like, well, why don't we talk about stuff we do together, but we don't ever do anything together?
Yeah, we were going to record a podcast last night, and we didn't. And we just ended up talking for an hour, and it was really nice.
Yeah, it was really
like, just as friends.
It's so fucking rare that we get to do that.
But I think when it must be really interesting when you have sort of a quasi-fictionalized version of yourself, because it's television, you basically have to take a sector of your personality and characterize it, because that's television.
But that's also tricky too, because I don't know how calculating that really. I know that some people. One of the things that I see is different about me as a performer and as a comic is that I seem to have gotten into it to sort of become myself. Like, I know there's a part of me that lives on stage and there's a certain muscle that I lock into. But when I was writing these scripts, I played them very earnestly. And I think that as the show evolves, and if we do another season, because I'd never acted before and I wasn't really looking at myself as a character, what you see happen is like, well, that's what this guy does. That you see that more than I calculated it.
Sure.
I see it now. So I think one of the challenges is sort of looking at these 10 episodes, and if we go into a second season, to say, well, what is it? Where can we put this guy? You know, what are his strong suits? You know, how does he function? So sort of building that character or seeing what the character of Marc Maron is in the show is something evolving.
Is there a part of you that will look at a script and go, you know, I personally wouldn't do this, but this Mark would do this?
Well, yeah, there was definitely stuff like that. Yeah. Like, let's put him there, you know, because I can see myself doing that. I'd like to do it.
Yeah.
So let's go ahead and give that a try. It was all very exciting like that, because all this stuff is very close to the bone. But a lot of it is doing that, which is like, well, you would do, you know, you could put your character there. And I'm like, yeah, let's go ahead and put him there.
Yeah.
And that's sort of interesting because, you know, when I meet up with
that's going to be odd. That's going
to
be weird.
It is because I try to be myself as much as possible. And at some point, you have to realize that everybody acts a certain way in certain situations. There's different manifestations, different parts of your personality that engage. And I'm just at this point after doing 10 episodes, I'm like, God damn, if we can do like if we really there's this, you just want to do more because I just want to see what I can, you know, how I can push myself in this medium to do it.
Well, I just be prepared that it, and it's funny that the second episode is about trolls. Because the more you
I
put
think that's your, the first one.
Is it the first one's about trolls?
I'm not sure. I know you saw three. I'm not sure what order they're going to happen
in. Oh, maybe. Okay.
Well,
so I saw.
On it, it said one, like season one, episode one.
Okay. So the first one was with Foley where you go see the trolls.
Yeah. Eric Charles Nielsen.
Fucking
that was based on a true story, but that's a good example.
You
went, of what we're
talking about. You track someone down?
Well, not physically.
Okay.
But what had happened was, you know, that was a way to sort of deal with this. And it was interesting because. What had happened was I went to someone else's comment board. Yeah, it was. Let's keep it vague so this guy doesn't get reactivated.
A special but, thing.
No, it wasn't a special thing, but it was a friend of mine who has a fairly active message board, and there was a guy on there literally campaigning to get people to hate me. Like he was, you know, he's taking parts of my jokes. He was calling me a misogynist and a racist. And like it seemed to be an active campaign.
But did he lie?
Yeah, you lie. It was an active campaign to get people not to like me. Yeah. He had a real problem with me. So I see his name on this comment board. I'm like, who is this fucking guy? And I see his avatar on the message board, which was a moving avatar, from Punch Drunk Love, right? So I don't know who this guy is. So I go onto Facebook and I type in his name, and there's a few options. So I go through those options and I find one, and his favorite movie is Punch Drunk Love. So I'm like, that's my guy. Mm-hmm. So then I start messaging him. I'm like, what exactly is your beef, man? I mean, if you're going to paraphrase my jokes, don't take them out of context. Put the whole joke down and then make your argument. Like, I wanted him to be righteous about hating me. Like, if you got a reason, don't mischaracterize it. And we ended up going back and forth. It went on and off for a year.
Wow.
And, you know, and then it got kind of ugly because the guy who's message board, he was on, you know, knew him as well. And it just got a little bigger. But over the arc of this whole thing, it was interesting. You know, about a year later, he's like, look, you know, I'm better now. You know, I was going through something. I think that there were similarities between us. So we kind of made up and stuff. But it did go on.
Now, let me ask you this weird question. Do you sort of feel like you're friends with that guy now because you shared this weird emotional experience?
Well, I find that if somebody's not just trolling because it's their hobby, you know, I think that we live in a culture where, you know, people like to do that. And they don't realize necessarily that we're humans, that, you know, there's nothing you can do with those guys. But the guys who are very specific and it seems to be a very personal thing that they're having a problem with are probably more like you than they want. They're yelling at you because they see you in them.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And interesting. And I didn't know if that would come around, and I didn't really anticipate that. But there was clearly something that we shared.
Well, there's also a certain amount of justice, I think, that's involved with trolling, where someone, if it's not just the blind, you know, like chaotic evil, let's tear everything down and burn salt the earth kind of guys, that they look at you and they go, you're successful. I don't believe you deserve that much success. I really need to tear that down because, like, they sort of decide.
Those are the guys who just want to troll for
No. I think not just trolling. Some people just want to troll for troll's sake, but other people get very
personal.
I don't
even think that person really exists.
What?
I think the troll for troll's sake isn't a real thing. I think that everybody.
Oh, absolutely they do.
I think that everybody that's trolling, there's something fucked up with them.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Everybody on the internet that's trolling, there's somebody touched them in a weird spot at some point in their life. And this
some
is
people just like
look,
some people just like making fires. I don't know.
And but, also, like, I have a bit of a bully in me, and I think a lot of trolls are bullies, mm-hmm. and they get activated, and they, you know, bullies can push bullies' buttons because bullies are generally very insecure and very reactive. But it is sort of profound how anonymously hurtful people can be. And it's disturbing, and I try to detach from it. But that whole story unfolded, and I knew that that was a good story. But I thought when we were writing it, and I wrote that one, it's sort of like, well, how do we get out in the world? And you're mentioned in that story.
We got to name it. He's like,
he loves the Nerdist.
Yeah. Like, you listed all the things the guy likes. I was like, hey. And then I couldn't tell if it was I was delighted nonetheless. I'm like, hey, he said our name.
Yeah. Well, I pulled Pete Holmes into an episode. Yeah. So that wasn't easy.
When I get a show.
Yeah. I had Pete be exactly who Pete was, and yeah, it's going to play kind of funny because he did get the show. Yeah,
exactly.
And all that stuff with the manager, that guy is based on my old manager. I mean, all the tics are sort of like, why are you looking at my hair? I mean, that's real stuff.
That's hilarious.
And but so that's how that kind of built out the troll story.
The trolling's going to get worse because the more you put yourself out there, the bigger the audience.
Well, I think that's really what I'm girdering up for. I think that, you know, it's very easy for me. I seem to respond to negativity, you know, and get it really, it kind of, I'm afraid to talk about this because, you know, But it takes a lot for me to kind of detach from it and not, you know, take it personally or react to it. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, when people are saying great things about me, that I've had people on Twitter go, why don't you respond to the good things?
Yeah.
Oh, I get that all the time.
Because other comics will make fun of me for only responding to people that compliment me.
Well, you know, what I try to explain to people sometimes is, like, look, as a comic, you're trained to zero in on a heckler or someone who's not having fun because – it's just the balance that you're trying to create in the room. And so when you get that in life, you sort of zero in on that person because you're like, all right, I got to fucking figure out how to fit. It's just, I feel like it's just part of the nature of what we do.
But even when I'm dealing with a heckler, you know, I want it to be, you know, I want to negotiate with these people. You know, I have that part of my personality where if someone's attacking me, I'm like, well, look, I don't like me all the time either. So let's see if we can find some common ground here and have an understanding about whether or not this is valid.
Do you think for like people that gain more and more fame, is there a point where there's like so much, like there's going to be like for a lot of people, there's going to be so much negativity on top of tons more positivity? But it's going to be so much that you just don't even fucking bother anymore.
Well, I think that it becomes taxing. Like, I don't have a Google search on my name. I don't go to comment boards, really. My comment board on my site is very limited. And there's even a couple of douchebags there. And I've really learned, not unlike when I interview somebody on the podcast, that if I didn't get what I thought I wanted out of an interview, you know, that's my own business. Because people are going to have a relationship with these things that it's not on you to dictate. Look, if someone's pissed off about something, what am I going to be like? Well, I think you're wrong to be angry about that because you didn't understand where I was at. It's not on me. After some point, you just have to say, well, that guy's going to be that way. That guy's going to have his feelings. And that, you know, I got to let that be.
And also, if you go to an article about someone that you already hate just so you can bitch about them, fuck you. Like, that is ridiculous. I mean, I don't, you know, for some reason, like a month ago, I just let it go. Like, I don't know what happened. I think I just couldn't. I felt like I was like, oh, I am taking myself way too seriously because, you know, I would see in these message boards, I don't mind criticism. I know people aren't going to think I'm funny. I know there are people out there that don't like what I do or they don't like the way I look or whatever. But it was just the ones where people would say, like, I hope you fucking die and I can shit on your mom's grave. I'm like, what is wrong? Yeah. And so it just at a certain point, I think it was kind of right around the mid-season of Talking Dead. I would kind of go through tweets during the show and a fucking lot would come in. And one night, you know, I just went, I don't have to do this.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of support, but then there's a chunk of like, you're the worst fucking person. It's like, and it's a waste of my energy. It's not fair. Like you said, to people who are nice to you. And I just thought, for me to get bothered by this, I'm becoming a person that I don't want to be, which is that I take myself so seriously that if anyone dares to say anything, that I'm like, hey, you know, and I just don't want to be that.
Like Ryan Adams, where he fucking like calls people that give him bad reviews, or if someone yells Brian Adams at one of his shows, he gives them back their money and has them leave.
I think that ultimately the reason why you react to it and the reason why, you know, at some point you have to rise above it is that it hurts your feelings. I mean, that, you know, that's what they want to do and that's what they do. And at some point, you have to either deal with your own insecurity around being hurt by vague fucking nameless attacks and shots at you and just say, like, you know, I don't know that guy. It's, you know, one tweet is not the entire internet. But for some reason, if a troll is really, acute, they hit your buttons. I mean, that's what you learn in those moments. Yeah. Is like, wow, this guy just tapped into these insecurities that I have. And now, like, now I'm worked up over bullshit.
Yep.
Like, there was a moment where it has to do with bullying, I think.
I think so. I totally agree.
And there was a moment where, you know, Jon Stewart and I have had, you know, we had issues when I was younger. And I did what I did to you earlier to him as well. And, you know, because of my own insecurity, you know, I thought anybody, you know, I was very territorial and very sort of, you know, kind of like, who the fuck are you? What are you doing here? This is, you don't, you know, and I bust his balls all the time to a degree that was inappropriate. And at some point, a couple of points, you know, when we were still sort of, you know, trying to have a relationship or at least a polite exchange, you know, I walked up to him and I started busting his balls. And he literally said, you know, I don't have to take this from you anymore.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't have to, you know, I don't have to do this. And it was to my face, and it was one of those moments where I'm like, yeah. Yeah, like, you know,
but it's our thing.
Yeah, you just
see the little Mac wheel processing, yeah. like you're accessing right. a file processor.
Hold on, let me render this information.
And he was right, you know, it was a pretty, you know, powerful moment, and I realized that. But there is a point where you have to be like, look, especially now, you just, there's no way, you know, that's why I don't engage with it. I'm just trying not to engage.
It takes a lot of energy and it's not worth it. And you also don't know the psychological, similar to what you said, you don't know the psychological state of the person who's attacking you. And
where they're at that day.
Well, yeah. And, you know, because social media is so disposable that someone will react emotionally in a moment. And there's a good chance,
It'll go away.
They might not even feel that way anymore. Sure. Like, oh, fuck, I don't know. I was having a bad day.
Right, that's right.
But
that's
then
right.
You build this whole story because you put them on the same playing field emotionally that you're on, where you're like, well, they're probably a reasonable person and they're coming at me with a planned attack. And it's like, nah, that was a dumb moment that just happened to be frozen in time because of the way the internet works.
I engaged with a guy recently who I blocked on Twitter. I said something bad about, you know, after he sort of took a shot at me. And then I got an email from him. You know, was basically one of those, like, you know, next time I see you at a show, you're going to wish you didn't do what you did because I'm going to verbally, you know, and I went back and forth with him. And I had this moment where I'm like, you know, look, if I'm your hate muse, you know, then I'm glad.
Please call your special that. Hate muse? That is such a fucking great name. Yeah. Hate muse.
Then, you know, there's nothing I can do about it. I'm glad I can help you out in that way. But it was also the moment where I realized that mostly it's very hack. Trolling is very hack because it's all the same. It's the same button pushing attack mode. They're interchangeable. When you look at emails or tweets from trolls, the tone of them is very specific. It's very, you know, narrow. And it's hackneyed.
Yeah.
So that sort of helped me. It's like, you know, trolls are hacks. I can frame it that way.
You can box it up that way and make it okay.
A little bit.
Well, just, I mean, you know, just try to, just know that with the TV show coming, there, you know.
The book, like, that's a whole other ball of wax.
Yeah, more people will attack you because of the TV show than the book.
Yeah, like, because the book you got to read.
The book takes effort. If someone buys your book, they're probably not going to buy the book going, I can't wait to read this so I can unload. You know, they're invested.
That's true.
Television show.
It's just out there.
Just out there.
Yeah, and be some live twirl tweeting.
Yeah. And you'll get a lot of support. And then, you know, in the beginning, you'll get more trolls because those people are just discovering the show. But they'll shake off and, you know, like, just don't.
Okay, Chris. Thanks, buddy. Thanks for talking me through it so many times.
Yeah, I know.
I've been through it so many times. And they go away. Like, they get bored. They, like, okay, they said their piece in the beginning.
And if you react to them, they won.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. But they
of course,
hate you sometimes, like, sometimes you're in a spot where you're like,
that's the thing. It's always when it's you're like, in a spot. Fuck. There's some I can go, fuck you, and then there's other times like, no, I can't.
How'd they know that? About
let this one go.
Yeah.
And then you get mad at yourself because you're like, you get mad because you recognize your own insecurities, and you go, God damn it, I should be better. I should be farther along than this.
What's weird? My biggest worries initially with the show and with the book too were. Not so much that. I mean, you know, I'm sort of getting better with that, and I think I'm okay in terms of detaching from that and actually feeling pride and excitement about what's going on. But you know, when you write a book of memoirs and you do what I do, what I got more concerned about with the show is like, how is my old man going to react? You know what? You know, like, did you know, how's my chick going to, you know, deal with some of this stuff? And there's negotiations around that stuff too. I mean, it was interesting when I was writing the book. And like literally right before I went into the final edit, you know, there was an essay that I'd written about my relationship, and I knew that I had to get her to sign off on it and to read it. And she read it. And this was like a big life lesson for me, you know, being sort of self-centered and doing what I do, that she read this and she's like, this is like this. I don't like the way this characterizes me. And you kind of let yourself off the hook, and this is completely biased to you. And you think you think that you're being diplomatic, but you know, you clearly you're not. And it was like days before I had to turn the manuscript in, and I'm like, so no, you know, like, but she was right.
Isn't that a weird feeling when you can, and it kind of scares me about my own brain sometimes when I can be so sure that I'm right about something. I'm like, how can you not see this point that I'm trying to make?
Right.
And then you get a little bit of distance from it, and then you go, how did I think I had this bulletproof defense the whole time?
Right.
That's really kind of scary.
Yeah, no, that was exactly the moment. Cause I mean, like, listening to her and I'm like, holy shit, you know, she's right. I should have been more considerate. And then you sort of ask yourself, well, am I censoring myself? Cause my chick, you know, who's wearing the pants around here? And then you start realizing like, well, it doesn't matter if you still want to, you know, be with her. Maybe. But
you can do whatever you want. There are just consequences.
Right. But emotionally, I mean, I think she was right. And, you know, and I ended up, you know, writing a newer essay that was a better essay about our relationship. And also there's parts of the show and the book that, you know, these are things that, you know, we've already worked through. That's the weirdest thing about writing memoirs. Like, you know, if I'm going to talk about my marriages, you know, those scabs are kind of healed up now. Yeah. But when you're doing memoir, you're like, I'm just going to pick at that one. See what happens, you know, because you really have no choice. So it was kind of difficult to kind of make decisions around talking about my life because there's other people involved in your life. And how's it going to affect those people? So my parents, I dealt with my mom. You know, I told her how she's in the book, and she's like, "Oh, I don't care." And I'm like, "Great," because you know it was what it was. But my dad, you know, I'm still like, it's still a little unclear how that's going to go. But after a certain point, it's like, well, you know, I won. Write your own book, buddy.
Well, you could sort of frame it like, this is going to be really great for that business you want to start. You know, like, people are going to hear about you.
Sure, man, you're the guy.
Any press is good press.
Sure. but like that was, the book is very personal too. And it, like, I guess this is the, you know, the rewards of doing what I'm doing, but like, it's still, I feel like I have so much on the line personally.
Which is so funny because it's not like you've stepped out of the shadows. Like you've been very open about yourself.
No, that's true.
For the last,
there's no big, there'll be surprises in that, you know, some of the stories go a little deeper than, you know, I talk about. And I think with writing, you get a little more, you can go deeper and you can, you know, paint a different picture and be a little more thorough about it. But yeah, I do know that people know a lot about me already, and they have their relationship with me. There might be a couple of surprises. Yeah, there's a few surprises in the book and in the show, I think, for some people. You know, because, you know, when you talk publicly enough, which you do as well, even though you're being as honest as you want to be, and even if you're overly honest, they still have the relationship. They still think what they think you are. They still have the idea of who you are in their head. They have the mark that they've decided you are in their head. And there's always going to be a little something that you throw in there like, well, the mark that I have in my head wouldn't do that.
I really have this experience.
But the real mark did that. So you might want to update or broaden your conception of
Mark.
Well,
that's been the most challenging. Well, by the way, are you dating Jessica Makinson?
No.
Oh, I thought you said you went out with Jessica.
Jessica, my girlfriend.
Oh, different Jessica.
Yeah.
Because I saw Jessica Makinson in the pilot in one of the episodes.
Plays the ex-wife.
Yeah, plays the ex-wife.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
different Jessica.
Yeah, no.
Because I haven't really seen, you know, I never see anyone socially anymore, really.
I think I ran into you with your girl That was a bad moment. It was outside of the Mohawk.
Yeah, right on Sunset.
And we had just had some sort of fight, and she was across the street. And you were like, hey, how's it going? I'm like, well, you know, right now, good to see you. Hello.
It didn't come off that way.
No, I'm very good at hiding
that. It came off. I'll be honest. You came off a little... You seemed a little shell shocked, but not aggressive.
Yeah,
you were just like
I had an angry girlfriend in the car. I was
across the street.
Yeah, she's sitting in the Lucy's laundromat right now, crying.
The angriest girlfriend is always across the street.
Yeah, exactly.
The best time to run into people.
Yeah, but like I'm such a relationships. We're doing really well right now, and things are going very well. And then there are those moments where things just get a little hairy. that was one of those moments, and it was my fault. I'll take it. I'll take the hit.
That's the new mark.
But I was saying what you were saying before about the audience has this idea of what you should be is that, I know that my stuff is personal on stage, but it's not like I'm not digging super deep as far as really talking about anxiety or things that, I graze across it and I talk about things that I like and I sort of talk about a lot of third party things and
I wish I could do more third party stuff.
When I start trying to do more like this is my real feelings about stuff, it sort of puts people off. And I just attribute that to I have not evolved the tool set yet to do what you're able to do, which is to still present those things in a way that's entertaining.
To certain people. I mean, there's always the risk of doing it that way is always that there's going to be people that might like you otherwise who are like, he's a little needy, a little too much information, a little too much information. Not my idea of a night out, whatever that guy's going through.
I have problems. I don't need to hear about your fucking problems.
Well, sometimes, that's the trick is that, like, how general are your problems? And I think that's relative to the type of audience you build. That if you're speaking personally, like, I, Mark Maron, went through this. It's a little weird. Maybe some of you can relate to it. As opposed to, like, hey, don't we all... It's a very different style of comedy. If you're looking to bond with people by sharing your personal experience specifically, no matter how peculiar that is, there will be people that relate to it. But there's also a general way to do it. It's like that standard sort of hackneyed, like men are like this, women are like this. Right? That there are some truths to those, maybe hackneyed premises. But the reason that they're still popular is there are truth to them. But if you're living an unusual life or you have an unusual brain, but you're still a person, but you're speaking personally, you're going to have a smaller audience. But the depth of what your experiences that they relate to is going to be a deeper bond.
Yeah.
They're not looking to you to sort of speak in generalities and find relief in your generalities. They're looking to you to sort of so they can have a little light on their struggle, which is specific. It's just a different, and I think that the world we live in terms of finding our audience, we're a little more able to do that.
Yeah.
But to be a mainstream act, you have to be a little more
general,
a little broader.
And at least start general and then kind of pull people in. But, right around the time that I started, like you mentioned, when I started talking about the nerd stuff and the shit that I was into, and I would go perform in mainstream clubs for papered rooms, basically, because I couldn't draw anyone.
Papered rooms are the worst.
So bad. And so, I mean, it's good to have to go through it, but you don't want it forever.
They just don't care.
It's very disposable to them. They got free tickets. They don't give a shit. Yeah.
They
fucking throw peanuts at you.
Yeah.
And people after the shows will be like, you don't look like a nerd. And I'm like, I'm talking about things that I love. Who are you to tell me that I'm what I am? And I feel that a little bit now when I start wanting to tell more emotional stuff.
It's so sad that that's really the biggest struggle that you have on a day-to-day basis is people questioning your nerd credibility.
They don't do it anymore that much. So
I did it. I'm sorry.
No, I don't care.
But seriously, I don't buy it.
I know.
I'm kidding.
Kind of. Even when... but that's fair. It's fair. It's fair for you to think that.
I think you've proven to everyone.
No, I think especially now with as much of a buzzword as kind of like the nerd thing is that it's natural and it's right to be suspicious about who's authentic and who's just trying to sell you a bill of goods. Yeah. I don't blame anyone for questioning
it. The difference between authentic and you don't need those glasses.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think it's the nature. I think the right people are questioning stuff, and that there's nothing wrong with that.
Like those are these are not life. Yeah, this is not these aren't questions that you know the future of civilization hinges on.
I only get really disappointed though when people like when the sort of like the nerd on nerd violence happens, and it, and someone's
what
like,
is that what? Like?
That's like
are you just talking about when that guy stabbed that guy at the Harry Potter panel?
Well, there's that, but I also mean when people call out, you know, and they go, "This person." Hey, everyone, that person didn't do, you know, if someone's trying to sort of help expand the community in a positive way, then fucking don't try to tell everyone.
The nerd community?
Yes. I mean, because people get mad, like the Comic-Con's gotten so become a pop culture con.
It's so weird to me that like you like I'm so not a nerd, but I'm not anything really, you know, like I was always sort of a loner guy. But like the whole like I wouldn't even know what to do with Comic-Con.
Really?
I honestly, like, you know, like, I've tried to examine my obsessions and tried, because I think that being a nerd requires a sort of committed obsession over many years to specific things, you know, whether they're comic books or whatever, sci-fi, or just an engagement in certain behaviors and entertainment ideas that, like, I look at my comic book experience, and this is just, I'm just speaking in a general way, like, there was a window of time that I didn't grow up reading comics, but when Hellblazer and Sandman came out, I got very into them. I was into underground comics, but it stopped. Like at some point, it was like I was walking out of a comic book store with 12 comics, and I'm like, this is exhausting me.
Yeah.
And it was over. And I have two boxes of comics, and I was into Swamp Thing, Hellblazer, Sandman, and some off the grid ones, and I have those. The first Sandman, but it was like I moved through it, like it did not stick. And anything that I get obsessed with, I generally move through it. I don't make a life out of it. So in terms of like Comic-Con and a community and that stuff, I wish on some level that I would know what to do there, but I don't go out all that much. And I would get there and I'd be like, what am I doing here? What happened? I don't know. Like, I look at your, when I'm festering over iTunes, I look at your guests and five out of 10 times, like, I can't even be jealous of you because I don't know who the fuck you're talking to. Yeah. Like, I'm like, who the hell is that guy?
I look at
the information. I'm like, I would never even know what to say to that person.
I'm glad you brought that up. I never get jealous of guests because I just don't. And I've been jealous twice in the past 2 months of you. You had Michael Keaton and Dick Van Dyke. And you released Dick Van Dyke the same day that we released Lily Tomlin.
Yeah.
And I was so excited about that. And someone was like, Mark had Dick Van Dyke. And I was like, what? Oh, man.
Dumb fucking Lily Tomlin.
But I didn't even.
Joy in Mark's face. As you
and it, but it wasn't
said.
Even like a.
I had that feeling with Lily Tomlin with your show. And like, quite honestly, when I got Mel Brooks, you know, I was joking about it on stage. I had to listen to your Mel Brooks interview. Which was good.
That's nice.
But I was listening to a lot because I knew I was dealing with a guy that's very used to telling the same
stories. Of course.
So I really needed to get around that. But it's weird when we all share guests, but it always is a different interview.
It's fun. And that's exactly, I mean, the idea with the podcast, if someone says like, well, if someone's on one show, I can't listen to another show. It's like, yeah, you could. It's like saying you could only ever watch one comedian. Like someone could do your show the same day that they did mine, and people could get two different halves of that person.
Yeah, because you're talking about what's happening now. It's that these are conversations that are happening in a moment. You don't know really where they're going to go. And to sort of make general assumptions about people, especially that have had careers like Lily Tomlin or Dick Van Dyke or any of these people in relation to one conversation, like, well, they're now I'm not going to listen to the other one.
Right.
Well, then, then that's the kind of person you are. That says more about you than it does about, you know, the interviews.
Yeah.
Because podcasts are the reason they're great is that they just have their moments in time. They're an hour of someone's life. And however anyone's going to drive that conversation is really up to that person. And they're going to be different.
And I don't get I don't stew about it. I kind of feel like, oh, fuck. And then I go, and then it's kind of like, ah, good for him, the son of a bitch. Because it makes me work harder to try to get, you know, to try to make my show better. Like, I feel like there is competition that is healthy. There's competition that's dangerous, but there's competition that's healthy that's like, you know, you keep your show, you keep me on my game because I feel like, oh, I can't. I have to make sure that, you know, we're putting up a quality show. But there are guests that we've been offered that I heard that they were going to go on your show, and I honestly thought Mark's going to do a better interview with this particular guest, like Billy Bragg was someone. They were like, do you want Billy Bragg on the show? And I was like, and they said, he's going to do Mark. And I go, you know what? Normally I would say I don't mind doing both, but I think Mark's going to do the better interview with Billy Bragg. So I was like, why? I just kind of felt like I'm not going to bother.
And it was good.
I'm sure it was.
But also, like, you know, we do... We do different things, and I think all of us do different things, despite, you know, people saying that they're doing my show, like out loud, other podcasters saying that I'm doing Mark's show in my version. But, you know, he's okay too. But I
laser.
But and he loves any sort of attention, but. But the thing is like with me, I don't feel the competition in as much as like I'm only my show is specific to it's my garage. These are candid conversations, and I have to fight the competition thing because it took me a long time to realize that my conversations with anybody are going to be different than anyone else's.
Sure.
But I do get jealous of booking because booking's tricky, and getting people is still tricky.
Yeah.
And yeah, like sometimes it's sort of like, well, is there a window? How can I talk to that person? But now lately, I've just been doing interviews that that with people that maybe nobody really knows or people that have been off the grid for a while. I mean, sometimes I get opportunities with musicians because I seem to do okay with them.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't know. That would be interesting. Like I had Huey Lewis on.
What?
Yeah. And he hasn't been on yet. I haven't put it up yet.
Oh.
Well, what about the news?
Yeah, huh?
What about the news?
No, the news weren't there.
Fuck that thing.
But they're always close.
Oh, my God. Andy Kindler's joke of Huey Lewis and
what else is in the news?
That's Huey Lewis if he was a comic.
But, like, for me, like... Yeah, it is funny. One of the things...
You know, another thing Andy said once.
I love Andy. But one of the things that I've been finding that I'm fascinated with, only because maybe it's my age, is that you have these people... That had a tremendous, cultural significance, in a brief period of time. That I interviewed Thomas Dolby because it was offered.
He's awesome.
Yeah, but like, am I a huge fan? Am I nerding out on it? Like Huey Lewis too. With musicians, it's tricky because you get guys that have been doing music for 20 years, and you listen to three of the records, you love them, but you enter a conversation knowing that they did 12 other ones.
Yeah.
I mean, I interviewed John Cale recently, and that was very intimidating, and it was tricky.
Yeah.
But what I've become fascinated with is that. When people fall off the radar, the cultural radar, in your brain, you're like, what happened to that guy? Well, yeah. I'll tell you what, they kept working, and there's a real good chance that they've been doing the best work they've ever done in the last 5 years, and that's 20 years from when they were relevant.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a sort of a sadness, but a respect that's owed there, is that because of the way the culture machine works, is that if people are making a bunch of people money and making hits, that's when they're relevant. But then, after those 3 years, it's like people just assume like, well, they fell off the map. It's got to be a sad story. And usually it's not.
No,
usually they're doing
or...
amazing things that a very limited audience is going to take in anymore. And it's sort of heartbreaking. And I've become sort of fascinated with that. What do those people do for the rest of their life?
Yeah.
And talking to them about that, because if they're big enough, they do have a loyal fan base, and they've probably made plenty of money, and they're probably okay. But it must be sort of difficult to be an artist who was relevant for a short period of time, and then all of a sudden, the spotlight goes away. And how do you not just become a nostalgia act or only significant to, the core group of people that like you?
Well,
how do you maintain?
I feel like that hits our type of person more in the heart than most people because we're
comics?
Performers. Yeah. And it's like, you can't, I mean, I feel like we have this sort of mutant power that we can go perform even if the rest of the business says like, we're not going to hire you, but people still have to show up for you to really be able to go on the road.
It was one of the reasons why I was so intent on interviewing Robin is that the reason I interviewed Robin more than anything else was I got tired of hearing 20-year-olds say, nah, Robin Williams is a hack and a thief. And I was like, what are you fucking, even if you don't like the guy, he did everything that you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it better than, like, he was a stand-up, he did television, he's had a career in movies for your entire lifetime. Yeah. And you're going to sit there and go, damn, fuck that guy. Yeah. Well,
his career is pretty remarkable. Like, he was just blew everyone else off the stage. Then the sitcom was huge. And then went into, like, it was very plausible that even just after the sitcom,
never gonna work again.
And it's like, oh, he's doing dramatic roles, and he's not just, it's really hard to do that.
And it's just fascinating to talk to these dudes that have been around a long time and are not necessarily, you know, bitter, but still doing, you know, great work. Like, I've become a little obsessed with it, actually. And it was pretty amazing talking to Mel, because, you know, Mel Brooks is a guy that, like, he's had 2 and 3 careers that, like, out of nowhere, you know, the producers becomes this thing, and he never stops working, and everyone remembers him for how they want to remember him. But that's a guy that's never stopped producing things.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to me.
And he's not done. And like, the way that he talks, he's not done.
No, he just keeps going. He's one of those guys, he needs to keep going.
Yeah.
Well, it brings up the point of, like how does one define success? Is it, like, people knowing who you are? Is it doing what you want to do?
Right.
Is it, like, you know, is it making a ton of money? You know, because you could say, like, someone on a sitcom, say they just made a bunch of money on a sitcom, like, in the 70s and 80s or whatever, and they just haven't worked yet, like, since. But they're still, like, living a comfortable life, and they're still very happy with themselves. Are they successful? Well, no one knows who they are anymore, but are they still successful?
I think if you're happy, that's the one thing.
That's what it should be.
I think
the one thing you hear with people like Mel Brooks and even sort of, like, there are people that I don't remember which friend of mine said it, but, like, we both interviewed Grohl, and there are some people in the world where you really get the feeling that they won life, and that, you know, and their disposition reads that way. It's like, yeah, they keep working, but they're sort of like, hey, like, what have I got to, what am I going to be mad about?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm living, you know, I'm doing what I want to do. I'm doing it well, and I'm living a good life.
And that's an interesting thing. Like, you know, Dave Grohl didn't have to start another band. Like, clearly Chris Novoselic just decided to, like, go do other
things.
I'm
good. Yeah.
He's like, I'm good. I can live the rest of my life off of Nevermind, pretty much.
Yeah.
Dave Grohl continued to, to him, success was continuing to just be creative and make things.
I think the important thing is to, and this, there's not really a dollar value on this, but I think as long as you're pursuing stuff that you genuinely care about and working around people that you genuinely like, and that can somehow sustain itself, then you're successful. Like, it's then you
got to believe it.
Then you if you don't have to take jobs that you don't want, that's the ultimate success.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah,
that was sort of my
doing
thing.
Doing what you want to do.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you know, again, going to the comic brain thing, who knows how long it'll last, but kind of realizing, like, oh yeah, if I take a job now, it's because I want to work on it. And if I don't take something, it's because I realize, like, well, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that at all. So I'm not going to do it. Like, that's to me is a tremendous gift.
That's a great feeling
to have.
It's a great feeling to be like, nah.
Because I'm just being able to say no.
I've taken more, you know, in the 18 years that I've been working, I've taken more than enough jobs where I was like, well, I could probably find a way in this emotionally, and, you know, it's going to help me not have to worry about money for 6 months.
Yeah.
You know,
like, for me to say no to, like, something someone would really want.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I like ships, and I like mates. I mean, I don't understand why I can't just...
Yeah, that was a survival job.
I did some of those. I hosted a game show once. Didn't really pick up any traction, thank God. That when VH1 did the American version of Nevermind the Buzzcocks.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I shot like 12 of those. It saved me. I was broke, on the verge of bankruptcy. And I can't say I put my full heart into it. But it didn't pick up. No one even saw the fucking thing.
But it's really, I think the lesson that I keep trying to hammer into people is that, you know, you started a podcast because you were backed up against the wall, and then the podcast all of a sudden was a true expression of who you were and what you cared about. And then that was the thing that we kept having this idea coming up in the business of, like, no, a career is something that someone else gives you and they hire you for it. And you go work at a company, and the idea that, well, no, it's not, it doesn't have to be that at all. Like, you can just be, but figuring out who you are and what you want to say is very tricky.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, we all got, no matter who the rugged individualist is, or no matter how much the rebel spirit is in a particular performer, you know, you used to really have to depend on somebody to give you the break.
Yeah.
Someone's got to give you a break to try to make someone else money. And it's sort of interesting. Like, I just interviewed Phil Henry yesterday, and it's interesting to see these guys who have lived in that world of radio for that long, where you know they've been taken care of on some level, and now, like, as you get older, because these opportunities are available now, it's kind of scary for some of them to step out and like, you know, I'm going on my own now.
Yeah,
it's what I always wanted to do, but you get used to that other thing. I think that is the biggest sort of soul fucker in the world, is that you get comfortable.
Yeah.
And you live with the compromises, which I think everybody has to do to a certain degree at some point in their life or with some element of their life. It's just sort of like, yeah, but you know, I got health coverage, and that's important. There's a tremendous risk that a lot of people aren't willing to take, and I'm not so sure it's wrong for them not to take it, but because I had nothing, you know, I was in the position to do that. But
I think you gotta get uncomfortable for a little bit.
If you want to grow, you have to get uncomfortable. But I don't think
must be growing every day.
I don't think comfort is so bad. I just think complacency is bad. I think it's okay to be comfortable, because you should kind of get to enjoy your life sometimes. But
it should be all the time.
Oh fuck, you're right. I mean, but it's complacency where you're like,
what is it about the joy thing, though? The enjoying thing, like, is there? Because I always try to figure it out. Like, am I enjoying my life? Do I take the time to enjoy my life? And I think the only thing that deters me from that is that when you're enjoying your life, then you can't let that part of your brain sneak in that says, "So this is it? This is the big payoff." This,
we'll get to that payoff one day.
Yeah, yeah. So just I'm enjoying it. But we'll is this the limit?
Maybe I should buy another guitar.
Is this the ceiling of enjoyment?
Exactly.
You know, if you're asking that, you might not be enjoying it. I think it's the being completely in a moment and not in your head. Just like being in a moment and just experiencing it.
Yeah.
And not thinking ahead,
See, that's exactly it, to bring it full circle. You know when that happens? When I'm on fucking stage.
Perfect.
And that's why, you know, coming, you know, in the last few weeks before I did the stand-up, that everything started to sort of crumble in my mind, because I hadn't felt that selflessness. You know, playing guitar does it too, to a certain degree, but when you're on stage and you're just directly connected to what's going on right then, that's when that happens.
Well, and the fortunate thing is that no one really could, unless someone shoots you in the face, no one can really ever take that away from you, so you'll probably always be okay. Well, because, you know, I just, yeah. Right. You know.
With jizz.
Okay, jizz. Better than bullets,
I
think.
A jizz gun.
Either situation, not comfortable.
It's not coming out of a dick. It's like a super soaker that's filled with
cum. Okay, good. That'd be bad, but not horrible.
Like a super soaker 50 or a super soaker 200? What are we talking here?
Just the fact that you know the difference is a problem for me.
I've been trying to sort of implement this thing, and it's difficult, but it's the idea of learning from the past and planning for the future, but just trying to live in the present. It's very challenging sometimes, especially when you're...
Well, how much of your learning from the past starts with this? You idiot. You know,
I mean, maybe you're gonna fuck this up again.
Yeah. Change the tone of how you look at the past.
I don't have too many
regrets, you know. And you really have to sort of frame it that way. The future thing is a little tricky because... basically it comes down to, and it's like, how do I, what if shit goes wrong, or if I get old, which you probably will,
of course.
If you take care of yourself.
Not me, man.
Yeah. No, not
this guy.
But am I going to be okay? That's really what you're preparing for when the future comes. It's like, am I going to be okay when, you know, this all kind of fades?
Yeah, but listen.
Am I going to be able to afford to have someone take care of me?
When you were 25 and you probably thought to yourself, oh my God, when I'm 49, I'm going to be a fucking, you know.
Yeah.
And now at 49, you're probably the best that you've ever been.
Yes.
So
without question.
The odds are that when you're 69, there's an equally good chance that you'll be fine.
Okay, well, you've been very encouraging, Chris, and I appreciate that.
If only I could tell myself.
I'm not saying it for you. It's like I've told this story before. It's like because I sort of felt like, you know, when we were both a lot younger, that for whatever reason, you were my natural nemesis, that I came to you when I had this drinking problem, and I'm like, well, if I get advice from Mark, it's probably going to be real advice because I know he hates me. And so when you gave me the checklist of like, look, if you have a problem with drinking, someone gave me this, and I always remember that you go, look, I get something out of this too. This isn't just for you. Like, that was so fucking funny to me. But I really, you know, I really appreciated
it. I was told that in Early Sobriety. It's like, when you help another alcoholic, that's how you stay sober. But you're not supposed to say that.
I even remember your body language, because you weren't even facing me. You were like, there was a sideways thing where you were like, here, you try this, you know, I don't know. But, you know, but again, it was incredibly helpful.
Well, the sideways body. Well, I'm glad I helped out. Reminded me, like, I posted this James Franco interview today or yesterday. I did a live James Franco with him and Harmony Korine.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, but it got really awkward. And you were talking about taking yourself seriously, you know, before.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, people started to listen to that thing. They thought I was being condescending. But you know how hard it is to talk to somebody who is really putting all their energy into not being funny or not.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
You
know, sure.
Where you're sort of like, you're just trying to connect and they're just assuming you're fucking with them.
Right.
So you kind of, well, Harmony kind of does that. But James, I was like, I wanted to talk to him about art and I wanted to sort of like feel him out and I wanted to, you know, get him comfortable. But by the time he got out on stage, he saw it was a comedy show and I could feel like I'm having a hard time because I'm going to have to talk about this on my show.
You think it probably would have been better to have him in studio instead of in front of people?
Yeah, I think so. But like people were saying that I was giggling at him, but literally I was uncomfortable because he got on stage and he turned his back to me and I'm like, what's going on? He goes, well, you're pretty close. I'm like, all right, well, I'll move back. You know, it was like that kind of vibe. The reason I'm just bringing it up is that, like, it's very hard to and I don't know if I do this as well, but when somebody is taking themselves very seriously, and it may be rightfully so, it's hard to lighten it up.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, it is. And I feel like we've been pretty lucky on this show that the benefit of having an hour to talk to someone is that if you chip away sooner or later, the defenses will probably come down.
They'll just relax, even if it's for a minute.
But being in front of a live audience for someone is rough if they're not used to that or if they feel like they could be attacked on all sides.
Yeah, that's true.
You know,
that's
so that's kind of a rough day. Anyway, but he'd probably come back on if you wanted him to come back on and do another one.
I hope so. Try to even it out.
Who else is there anyone else you have
coming
up? When
are you putting this up?
When's best for you? I'll put it up whenever you want.
I don't know, probably the last week of April.
Okay.
So, yeah, just the show and the book is coming out, and I don't have my podcast schedule in front of me.
What are your dates for the show and for the
May
book?
May 3rd is the premiere of the show, and April 29th, the book comes out. Cool. Attempting Normal is the book.
Fantastic.
Thanks, man.
Good to have you on.
It's great to see you. I think this is the best one yet.
I absolutely agree. I feel like the more of these we do, the closer
you two get.
Kind of.
I'm lightening up, man.
And look for Mark's next album, Hate Muse.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Hate Muse is such a great name.
Thank you, man.
That's such a great fucking thing.
I Hate Muse.
Do you go back and pull material out of your podcast at all from riffs and stuff? God damn it.
What?
I haven't.
That's what you're trying to do.
I know.
Because we improvise here, so I'd be remiss. Is that how you use that word? To not,
it would be comedically irresponsible.
Well, yeah, because like I speak freely, and something comes up, and I'm like, well, that seems like it could structure well. So why wouldn't I do that? And if people are sort of like, I heard this story, but you didn't really, because I put more work into it. I just kind of was flying by the seat of my pants, and now it's a nice.
It's kind of like
piece.
You know, like. Free flow writing, when you just start writing and you have to keep going because, like, it's a conversation. You have to keep talking. You have to keep on thinking of stuff. It's better that way.
So Marin, May 3rd, and it is great. I saw three episodes,
and
Judd Hirsch and Sally Kellerman and Andy Kindler and Dennis Leary and
Eric Charles Nielsen,
who was
Eric Garland.
But the way that Eric Charles Nielsen, like that, the den.
Did I get that right?
What,
as a nerd? You're nerds.
Yeah.
I mean, they were definitely.
He is that guy. He is that.
He is definitely that guy.
No, but I mean the vibe of it, because I didn't know. But apparently there are sort of like group play. You know, when they're.
Here's what I loved about what you did with them that was not, because at first I saw them and my honest reaction was like, oh no, the stereotypical nerds, and they weren't, because they were every bit as confrontational with you in person as they were online. Whereas I think a lot of people, if you confront them in person, are like, oh, I'm sorry, because they're not used to being confronted physically.
Yeah.
But you painted them in such a way where they were equally as like, you go, what, you know, you wouldn't say that to someone's face. And they're like, we're saying it to your face now.
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
you
yeah.
made them bullies yeah. and defend. And that, I thought that was a really great.
Why don't you go ride your cat crapped in your car. Why don't you go ride him on my show about it? He was really good. I wanted him to do it too. I'm glad he could.
Yeah. So May 3rd, Marin, IFC and WTF, which Thanks, is buddy. Up Mondays and Thursdays,
That's right?
That's right. Yeah.
Stamps.com/WTF.
Yeah. All right.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.
Hey, listeners, it's Will Arnett. Our podcast, Smartless, has crossed a milestone that seemed unfathomable when we started nearly 4 years ago, as we've just released our 200th episode. Join us as we welcome the dynamic duo of hilarity, Steve Martin and Martin Short. You've seen them on screen together in The Three Amigos, Father of the Bride 1 and 2, and most recently, and only Murders in the Building. Both are comedic geniuses in their own right, but together they are always electric. And this episode of Smartless is no exception. I don't know if I've laughed more in a single episode than this one. We discuss their career arcs both separately and as a comedy team, how they met, who is more difficult to work with, and what motivates them today. Is Steve a better banjo player than Marty as a singer? Find out on this bicentennial episode of Smartless. Follow Smartless in the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Smartless ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Plus, you get to hear Sean cry. What a loser!